Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 49. At the crossroads of meditation and activism, a conversation with Arya F. Jenkins. Jenkins is a peace activist, poet, and writer whose poetry has appeared in various literary journals and magazines such as Book Press, the Cafe Review, the Connecticut River Review, and online in the Golden Lantern and the Right Room. Her work also appeared in No War, No More, a collection of poems and essays for peace and against war that she also edited that was published by Greenwood Blue Lotus Press in 2007. Longtime practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism and studied at Namgyal Institute of Buddhist Studies in Ithaca, New York. She'll be reading from her chapbook, Jewel Fire, a collection of Buddhist poems, which was published by All Book Books. And some of her poems and reports from Zuccotti Park during the Occupy protests are in the anthology The Un-Occupy Movement, also published by All Book Books. Monk, thanks for listening. Welcome, Arya F. Jenkins, to Between the Lines. It's very nice to have you on today. And how are you doing? You're in New Jersey or you're traveling around?
I'm in New Jersey right now, Monk. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
It's a pleasure.
I was thinking beforehand that one of the best things about being a small press publisher is meeting people like you. You know, interesting people that are writing and also living what they write. So it's an honor to have you on. And before we get into your chapbook, and you also have some pieces in another book that All Book Books published, to your written works that All Book Books has published, I wanted to find out a little bit about how you got into Tibetan Buddhism. You started in the 1990s, correct?
Yes, actually, that's right. I actually began sitting practice in the 80s with a Western teacher, and then in the 90s traveled to Ithaca and studied there for a while at Nangyal Institute of Buddhist Studies. So I was able to develop my practices there.
And what was there anything particular that got you interested, you know, when you first started meditating?
Well, I knew one of the partner of my first teacher was actually a Tibetan Buddhist, and I really liked the way that she would sit in practice and mm-hmm. rise in practice. She was a very quiet person, but it was a very full and rich kind of quiet, and I admired it and wanted some of that in my own life. So when the opportunity came and Nangyal opened up, I was all set to go and try, you know, study and learn some more about Tibetan Buddhism besides just the sitting practices that I've been doing.
Right. And were you writing from earlier times too, or did that come out of the meditation?
No, I've always been writing.
Okay.
And I would say the two constants in my life have always been searching spiritually and writing. The two have you know, entwined at different times, and it's still sometimes a struggle to entwine them, not so much in my own private world, but in terms of reaching the public with a message that doesn't sound, you know, like a teaching of some sort,
right.
A sharing from the heart.
Yeah, that comes through. I mean, in the book that I published, Jewel Fire, you mentioned that. I think it's in your author's end note. I was reading that over before the interview, and you know, just that feeling really conveys about just even in the beginning, you have a prayer, trying to find it. You have a dedication, and
right.
You know, may this prayer bless and endow all my actions and words with the most sacred intention. So it's, you know, I find that refreshing. That sort of the sense of sacredness that someone who is more focused on a spiritual path or a practice that brings to the arts is, you know, I find that an added thing.
Well, language is so important, and we kind of lose sense of how powerful it can be and even how sacred. And I always try to remember what its power is and where it comes from, where that power is rooted for me. So especially in writing this kind of poetry, which was inspired by my practice. And, you know, not all of my writing is necessarily, but certainly my practice has infused my work and helped to make it better, that's for sure.
Yeah, was there a noticeable difference once you,
yeah,
when you started writing afterwards?
Helps to focus your thoughts, helps mm-hmm. to focus you in general, and sort of aligns you with the universe.
Right.
And, but I would say, you know, and this connects again to my book because it's dedicated, some of the proceeds of this, chapbook that we published, went to, a nunnery in northern India. And one of the great experiences, if not the single most, wonderful experience I had while studying at Nangyal was meeting, a Tibetan Buddhist nun who's a British born nun named, Tenzin Palmo. And she was the first Tibetan Buddhist English-speaking teacher who was also a woman that I'd ever encountered. And so the combination was really fruitful, really, really special. I assisted her with a tour on the East Coast subsequent to meeting her. And then she went back to India and started a nunnery, the Dongyugat Saling Nunnery, for young women in her tradition. And young women, that includes many young women who have escaped Tibet and have nowhere to go. And the nunnery is particularly important and rare because it teaches young women on the same level that the monks are able to study. The standard in Tibet and in India has been that only the monks get all the teachings. The nuns are consigned to the kitchen and, you know, to sweeping up. And it's very, very fortuitous that we're speaking now because actually today it's nuns at Jam Yang Cholin Nunnery near Dharamsala, starting their exams for the Tibetan equivalent of a PhD or Geshe title. And to give you an idea of what this might be, imagine if only until now men alone had been allowed to take their final exams and get their doctorates. So in the West, you know, the first professorial degree was awarded to a woman 300 years ago in 1732 to a scientist named Laura Bassi. And 2,500 years ago, the Buddha had admitted women into his order, including his own foster mother, Mahaprajapati. But, you know, since that time, since that revolutionary decision on the part of the Buddha, there has been, you know, setbacks in terms of the cultural direction. And, you know, the ordination lineage unfortunately did not migrate when Buddhism spread from India to Tibet. And so Buddhist nuns have been sort of cast as inferior for many years. And a side effect of this has been that they don't have access to the full curriculum. Only fully ordained monastics can study ethics in their entirety and so forth. And Tibetan Buddhist nuns have to travel to Hong Kong or Korea, where the Chinese lineage ordination is alive, and they're able to receive full ordination in that, but it's not, you know, it's a lineage they're not necessarily familiar with, and the nuns usually don't have means to travel to those countries. And even when they can, you know, they want to be ordained by their own lamas or teachers and in their own tradition. The teacher that I met, Jetsungma, is now Jetsungma, which means the most senior Western-born Tibetan Buddhist nun alive today. And she's done remarkable work and is has not only helped to launch this, you know, wonderful nunnery for young women, but many other projects with the same spirit of helping to feminize Buddhism and to bring it into the present and into the future. His Holiness the Dalai Lama is all for the empowerment of women, but it hasn't been just his decision as far as getting this empowerment to occur. So there are many discrepancies. You know, to this day, the nuns have to obey 98 more precepts than the monks do. And if a monk of whatever, you know, of 1 year tells a senior nun what to do, that nun has to obey. She always has to take a back seat to the monks, and it's not a just system. So these things are very slowly but very surely turning around, thanks in very large part to the work of Jetsungma.
Wow, yeah, it's neat to hear some of the inner workings, as well as to you know, get a sense of the progress and the egalitarianism happening. There's a website that has the nunnery, tenzinpalmo.com. It's TENZINPALMO, like the hand, PALMO.com.
Exactly.
So people can look for more there.
And her latest book is Into the Heart of Life, but there's also more mention of this need for the feminization of Buddhism and the current feminization of Buddhism in a book called Dakini Power. I haven't had a chance to read it myself, but I saw it referenced in some material I was looking at before our discussion.
Oh, I hear bells. That was a sound like a train bell.
That was my car.
Oh, okay. That was like a ding of approval or something.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
What you're talking about reminds me of, from what I've learned of, this era that we're in, starting, you know, around 2012, in Latin America, they speak of the age of the Pacha, which is like the rising of the feminine energies.
Mm-hmm.
And, so that it's neat to see, you know, what you're talking about happening with Tibet. It seems like along those lines that, you know, more, not only awakening for the whole planet, but this rise and deeper respect for the feminine energy and connecting with the earth in that way.
Right.
But you know, it's neat to see how the Tibetan practice is evolving.
Yes, it is.
Now, how?
Or rather, not necessarily the practices, but those
right.
who are practicing.
Yeah, that's a good, very good distinction. Thanks for astute editorializing. Now, you also do a lot of activism. So, how did that get started? Were you doing that way back when? Because it's an interesting combo of. I find that in general, meditation and activism, they're almost like opposites. You know, we have the sort of stereotypical hermits or monks or nuns that are off, you know, in the temple or monastery, and then the activists who are out there, you know, going wild sometimes. But the blending,
exactly.
I think the blending is very essential. Can you talk about what that's like for your life?
I've always had a social consciousness. My mother was a writer from South America, and she had a social consciousness that was infused, that I was infused with at an early age. And certainly if you live in Bogota or Peru, where I did, you have a sense of the, you know, of class and of poverty and of inequities. So when I came to Tibetan Buddhism, to sitting practice, it was really a way to quiet myself in the midst of a culture that really doesn't support interiority of any kind or quiet inner quietude of any kind. And I saw a real need for my energies to be stilled if I wanted to be a more thoughtful person and a more productive one. So that's why I began sitting practice. But for me, again, I wanted to study the roots of that practice more, and I wanted to cultivate a larger awareness of what the Eastern traditions had to offer. And so it was a very natural calling to study and to research and to participate in many of the studies, for example, that I was able to get at Nanyal.
Oh, that's fascinating. Now, do you, your middle name, Francesca, reminded me of, did you ever see the film Brother, Son, Sister, Moon? It's about St. Francis.
No, I haven't.
I haven't
seen that movie.
It's a wonderful film, but I guess the mother calls her son Francesca. I'm not sure how that works in Italian or whether that's, you know.
Francesco?
Yeah,
Francesco,
maybe
probably.
She says, but it sounds like it. But that's in the movie, they show Claire as she was the first nun that was accepted in the Franciscan order.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that was way back in the... gosh, I forget. I think it was like 1300s or 1500s. So it's just neat to connect the sort of lineage, some of the dots there.
That's an interesting mention of someone. St. Francis was sort of a Catholic hermit in many ways, but he was also a real activist. He was very much on his own, but he was a lover of nature, a helper of human beings, and with very little, he's a beautiful example. And the monks and nuns of Tibet and India are also examples of this, how with very few material possessions, but with a great heart of intent, you can really transform your communities and your world. A lot of the nuns that are studying at the Dongyuga Saling Nunnery, for example, will become nurses or maybe counselors and social workers and educators in their communities, and will help to support them in the ways that an activist does here in this country. Basically, you have to be an activist in this world if you expect it to turn for the better, because we don't live in very positive times. We have wars everywhere, and there's all kinds of crap happening. So you just... to live and breathe, really, and to behave properly from day to day requires you to be an activist. Even if you don't consider yourself one, you certainly are.
Yeah, and in some form or another, I think it is. There's some story, that, as they say, like, it's easy. It's sort of the meditation part is kind of easy in a way that it's, when you get out sort of in the world, that you test what you've, you test your practice. I'm sort of just generalizing that that storyline. That's someone can meditate, but then they go out and somebody cuts them off in traffic and they go nuts. So
exactly.
You have to
those are the constant tests. Exactly, Monk. Those are the constant tests that we encounter every day. I mean, New Jersey is a location where honking is part of the culture.
Mm.
It's not something that I like to do, really, because if I hear a honk, you know, or if an elderly person is honked at, for example, as they're crossing the street, that can ruin somebody's day, you know? So why would you want to do that to anyone? And why do you want to, you know, it's just not something that you, so in many ways, an activist, even on this small scale, and even in this most obvious instance, you have to go against the current. And you have to, you know, create your own stream if it isn't there. But that can be challenging, which is why people go into retreat or they go off into quieter locations. I left Fairfield, Connecticut and went to study yoga first and then went to study Buddhism in Ithaca. And it was about 7 years of just retreating into a better world, so to speak, before I felt I could really deal with what we mostly deal with here in the West on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, that is some of the, excuse me, that is some of the pattern of the, you know, Joseph Campbell talks about it, and the story of the Buddha is about the, you know, at, like the retreating from the world and then going back into it. So it's like the, you know, learning and strengthening oneself so you can go in and out of the different worlds.
Right.
Do you have your copy of the chapbook with you?
I do.
It's called Jewel Fire, A Collection of Buddhist Poems, and this was published in 2011, but we're just, this is one, sometimes I get books printed at the, you know, official print shop, and sometimes they're a little homemade chapbooks, so that's why we're reissuing or reprinting this version, so there, you know, another batch is available to people, and that's on the, you know, my website. It's $10 plus $3 shipping. And can we still send a little bit of the proceeds to the nunnery? Are you still doing
that? Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Always. Yes, absolutely.
Super. There's a couple that... go ahead.
I intend to be doing some readings, actually, in the Trumbull County area with a fellow poet and you know, hope to sell and distribute some copies there for this cause.
Right,
when I move out to Ohio, that is going to be in a couple of months.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that. There's a very strong activist contingent out there, and a lot of spiritualism and Buddhism as well.
Excellent. There's a couple that jumped out at me. I'll request, but you know, you can read something that you feel comfortable.
Sure.
There are two. The self and other is one, and then the next page is emptiness.
Okay.
We'd love to hear those read, and then, you know, if you could, we'll see after that.
Okay,
let's see, page 13 is self and other.
Right, I'm on that page now.
Okay.
Alright, I'll read that. I should preface with the statement with these books, this, book was, inspired by my practice, but it isn't, you know, it's not directed just to Buddhists, obviously, it's
right.
to all my friends, to anyone who, you know, to anyone, really, and they are really just quiet stories and words I tell myself, sometimes reminders.
I think, yeah, you bring up, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead, I just brought up such a
no,
good
that's
point.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a
go
good
ahead.
Point that as an artist, I think there's a distinction between, you know, sometimes one finds a book that's like an official book on Tibetan Buddhism or Native wisdom or whatever the culture, but then as artists, There's kind of a translation process where, you know, we may be influenced by various traditions, so that gets into the expression, but it's not necessarily, you know, it's not meant as a direct, specific teaching, so to speak. So
Right. I'm reading the Dharma Bums right now, which is Jack Kerouac's, you know, in many ways, contains a lot of his interpretation of mm-hmm. what Buddhism is, and it's really, you know, it's wonderfully exciting to see someone an American in that time period, you know, despite the problems that Jack Kerouac had, he understood the heart of the teachings,
mm-hmm.
and that's so important, you know, because, you know, religion can be so complicated, but like His Holiness the Dalai Lama himself has said, practice kindness. If you don't have a religion, you know, it's about practicing kindness, and that's at the root of all the religions, so... Let me read self
okay.
and other. Self and other. You can't chastise people for what they do. Even that most precious person in your life, that significant other, for whom you would do anything. You can't expect that person to be God, Jesus, or Buddha, or anybody other than who and what they are in the moment. You know that cliche that says every time you point a finger, four others are pointing back? It's true. Look in the mirror instead. Clichés help us realize the obvious. If I'm not happy, if I'm afraid, it's not because of you. It's my mind, not somebody else creating havoc. If I see only ugliness in the world, it's because my blinders are still on, and I haven't yet gotten to that pure, precious place inside, that center from which all looks both fresh and familiar.
Very nice. There's both, there's a lot of deep stuff, and then I even like the cliches help us realize the obvious. That's a great line, too.
Thank you.
It reminds, I had not heard of that cliche about the fingers, so that was nice. But I like the cliche that cliches are not obvious, or help us.
Actually,
so
I don't know if
reminder.
That's a cliche, but it's a it's sort of a maxim in psychotherapy and in psychology. I have many friends who've been, you know, a lot of people in the West have spent many years in psychotherapy. That seems to be sort of a prelude and in some cases a sidestep to spiritualism of any kind. But, you know, what they have learned, all of them seem to come out with that message that their therapist says, you know, when they start criticizing someone extensively, they're really referring to themselves.
It's like anything that you, I mean, sometimes there is a place to say, well, you know, maybe somebody doesn't clean the dishes properly, they need to be told about it, but it's also like if you're noticing something in someone else, it's good to check it, you know, like why does that person do that annoy me so much? Well, you know, maybe it's something I got to deal with.
Yeah.
I also love the ending of that poem because it's, you know, if I see only ugliness or whatever in the world, it's like, again, check yourself, because sometimes, you know, sometimes people casually say, you know, the world's just all a crazy place. It becomes this sort of overgeneralized negative statement, and I think it's helpful to relook, you know, to check who, mm-hmm. what eyes you're looking with.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Let's see. How about him?
Okay. That's on page 15, I guess?
Yeah, right there.
All right, emptiness. You can claim that it's all about you, or all about me, or all about us, but it's really about neither, or them either, but the energy in between, the quality of energy, the love.
Very simple and nice. That's a big topic with Buddhist philosophy and practices, that, you know, what is emptiness? And do you know, it just made me think of, I find fascinating the little bit of the Tibetan text, or Buddhist text. Well, they phrase these things in a way that just, it's like a Zen cone. It puts the mind in another state. It's like, you know, neither is it true nor not true. Do you know, like, is that coming from, you know, some kind of sort of Zen place, that those, the way they phrase questions, you know, really makes the sort of rational mind have to think and stretch?
Well, I know, I'm not sure what text you're referring to necessarily, but I do know that, you know, the goal in a lot of the practice, you know, the goal is really to have a mind without conception, mm-hmm. which is really difficult. I mean, I would imagine even more so for our Western mind, because we're so filled with junk all the time, you know. We just, everything from ads you see all the time, on the internet, on television, even on the street. It's very difficult to look at a person and to exist and to listen and to breathe and to be in a conceptual free state. But I believe that is what that particular statement is referring to, you know. And that's the state of emptiness.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you for explanation. Any other ones, or any particular poem you'd like to read?
In some ways these are the most private poems I've ever written, even though they're the most spiritual, because they come from that place that has to do with the stillness created in practice, and they don't come from your thinking mind, they come from, I guess, you know, your heart mind. Uh-huh. The Tibetan Buddhists have this beautiful notion that the mind is not centered in the cranium and the mentality, but in the heart. And it's actually a really beautiful thing to think about. So that's sort of where they come and from. And my particular favorite is really, really simple. So it's just called Flower Mind. And I'm going to read that at the closing.
Okay.
It is time, time to rise, time to end meditation, time to die. That is all I know.
All right, short and powerful. Now, what you are describing has been, I think, been mentioned on the show numerous times, because there's so many times the parallel with the Eastern traditions and indigenous Native American Turtle Islander wisdom of the heart mind.
Mm-hmm.
The Lakota friend Teocelyn Ghost Horse, you know, he speaks about that a lot, of how, you know, we're sort of taught to mind think rather than heart think, and that, you know, the natives, you know, to a large degree, that, you know, literally feel and think with the heart, which just to think about that is a kind of shift in what we're used to.
Yeah, that's where wisdom is, right? I mean, you know, you can't conjure wisdom in the brain. It really comes from a different center, and which is why, you know, knowledge is a word that, you know, tossed about a lot, you know, but it's not information, it's not how much you know of trivia, it's not even a lot of what is taught in schools, really. It has to do with traditions as much as anything else, and there's very little of that that's as explained and as well explained as many of the Tibetan Buddhist teachings are. For example, at almost any teaching I've ever attended, before you receive the teaching, you're told that it passed from such and such to such and such, to such and such, and then to us. And, you know, with many religions even, there's a sort of vagueness about the source, and there's no mention of the source, or there's no mention of the source. And so it's really, you know you're receiving not only historic language, but the wisdom of the ages, which is real knowledge when you are... you know, when you're studying the practice, when you're studying Tibetan Buddhism. I'm really not trying to sell it, but it kind of sounds like I am.
No. Well, I think it's fascinating because it respects the direct lineage that comes from
exactly. You know,
a particular person that took the time to study, and, you know, some other, you know, not to demean people's connection with whatever they get out of religion or their
right.
spirituality, but
right.
a lot of the stuff is like, you know, we don't, like Jesus said this and that, and it's, who knows if those were actual sayings, or a lot of times it's based on these sort of mythological sounding things, you know, Adam and Eve in the garden and biting an apple, and did that really happen? And yet people, you know, base... You know, wars are fought because people believe that. So it's, I think it's
right.
when a practice is grounded or rooted in direct lineage, it gives it a you know, some sense of something.
Exactly.
The back of the book, there's a nice Tibetan design, which is Om Ah Hum, which is explained as the mantra of purification that contains the basic syllables of all mantras.
Correct.
And then on the front cover is some. Sort of what one would not expect of the book, this kind of colorful, funky art by Diana
Ludwig.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's a wonderful artist. She's also got a website, www.dianaludwig.com, where you can see more of her art. And it's sort of, I guess it's her interpretation, really, of the spirituality contained in the language of the poem. So it's really, you know, I love the artwork. It's really special.
Well, the cover, I mean, because it's so colorful and it's got, like, little sort of cut-out fractals, it somehow it connected to the title, Jewel Fire. It's just sort of like sparks and flames. Can you say a little bit about where the title, it has a connection to a Tibetan image or text, the Jewel Fire?
Yes, Jewel Fire is... It comes from the prostrations to the 35 confessional Buddhas, specifically the lines of the Tathagata, Jewel Fire, I go for refuge. And fire is sort of a recurring theme in all of my work, for whatever reason. And so, I liked the idea or the image of Jewel Fire, a jewel is often referred to as, at the center of the heart in a lot of the tantric practices is a jewel, mm-hmm. and from that jewel emanates light and all the good things with which we want to nourish the world, and it's also the place that you receive all the good things that you hope to receive from the universe. So it had a few ideas in there that I really liked.
All right, excellent. Thank you again for writing the book and for, you know, doing the translation of what you, you know, the experiences and the ideas that come to you in the quiet time, and then being able to share that with the world. That's something that it does take a certain level of courage, for an artist to do it in a way that you feel comfortable with.
Thank you, Monk. I really appreciate your supporting the book, and most especially, I want to say that, you know, a lot of this inspiration came from, you know, thinking about what women in the East still have to go through, especially those studying for a spiritual path. And I really urge people to find out more about that, because it is absolutely true that this is the time of women in the world, where a gentler, kinder way has to be embraced, mm-hmm. and women will be leading in that path, and most especially women who are on a spiritual path with those objectives. So it's really important to support traditions that are nurturing young women and women in general along the lines of these traditions that help to create peace within and therefore generate peace in the world. It's extremely rare and precious to have that opportunity. And so anyone who is listening to this discussion, I really hope that they do go to Tenzin Palmo's website and to others that are suggested there, for example, and even to the literature that she has written, because it will help to transform your life.
All right, that was wonderfully said about the whole the feminine energy. Wanted to wrap up with a few minutes of you have a couple of poems and a little bit of an essay reporting in another anthology, an anthology published by Alba Books, The Unoccupy Movement, Autonomy of Consciousness, Practical Solutions, and Human Equality. And that was at the time, you know, the Occupy Movement, mostly you were at Zuccotti Park for a little while, and then you did some work in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So can
I'm actually trying to, I'm working with folks here to pass, sort of to pass the baton before I leave on, we launched Occupy Bergen County in November 2011. And so the only way that the movements can really get momentum, it seems to me, is with some sort of focus. And as you mentioned before, and to keep it on topic, you really, it would be great if everyone who was an activist practiced some kind of spiritual path too, because then you know that the wildness on the streets has a purpose, is contained, or is comes from a gentle heart. Obviously, violence is never going to get anything anywhere. The poem in Unoccupy came from the experience of seeing this beautiful revolution on the streets with a lot of young people and some middle-aged people and homeless people in the city during that period of time when Zuccotti Park was being occupied for peaceful ends and revolutionary ends.
All right. Thank you. Thanks so much, Arya. Appreciate all your ideas and writings. And anything else you want to add?
Thanks so much for the opportunity to share some of these thoughts, and I wish you luck with all your endeavors.
Hey, thank you very much.
It's so important, you know. So, I mean, there's very few publishers that really are searching for right thinking, right words, so forth.
Thank you very much. That's much appreciated. I found this CD. Maybe a friend gave it to me. We're going to go out with a couple of tracks. Lama Cheno, Cheno. There's one that is the Long Life Prayer, which actually has the Tibet in the liner notes. And then there's another piece, Compassion Mantra, which I think is the Om Mani Padme Hans.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the singer at all, or the Long Life Prayer?
Yeah, the Long Life Prayer for sure, but I'm not sure if I'm familiar with the singer.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, you'll... when you, you know, you'll hear it, and I'm sure you'll appreciate it. It's very, very peaceful, very relaxing, and I guess that's, you know, a lot of the point of a lot of meditation and music is to kind of, it's both relaxing and energizing. Put those two together is, I think, an important goal. So thanks again, Arya, and
thank you, Monk. Good luck.
Take care.
Take care.
Om Shanti Dene Seje Panchay Doje Sen Na Se Tanje Ye Se Prabhatam To Be Yes, I